Spiritual principles. Sorry, Eileen, I'll read that again. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And the spiritual principle along this step is spiritual awareness. I found the AA 12 and 12 particularly helpful on step 11. It really helped me with this step. And it talks about meditation and prayer being the main channels to a higher power. And in the introduction, in the summary of the steps, it says that there is a direct linkage among self-examination, step 4 and 10, and meditation and prayer, step 11. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit, but when they are logically related and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. And it goes on to say that meditation is essentially an individual adventure, something which each one of us works out in his own way. But its object is always the same: to improve our conscious contact with God, with his grace, wisdom, and love. And let's always remember that meditation is in reality intensely practical. One of its first fruits is emotional balance. With it, we can broaden and deepen the channel between ourselves and God as we understand him. The essence of this step is being willing to grow along spiritual lines. And I just think, who among us doesn't want emotional balance? Given where we've been in step 3 and what we've seen in step 4, who among us doesn't want that? And then I found this point in Language of the Heart on page 240 particularly powerful, and it's talking about neglect of step 11. And it says prayer, meditation, and the guidance of God is what we're talking about in step 11. The other steps can keep most of us sober and somehow functioning, but step 11 can keep us growing if we try hard and work at it continuously. If we expend even 5% of the time on step 11 that we habitually and rightly lavish on step 12, the results can be wonderfully far-reaching. This is an almost uniform experience of those who constantly practice step 11. And I don't know what your experience is, but I kind of jump into step 12 usually really gladly. I love step 12. I love working with others. I love, working with sponsees, taking people through the book, because I absolutely love the big book. So I find that a really easy part of my recovery. But as I'll share as we're going through step 11, I have found step 11 much more challenging. So that kind of really made me think that, I spend most of my time, and it says quite rightly, on step 12. But if I expend even 5% of that time on step 11, then, the results can be wonderfully far-reaching. And I just, that really, really made me think. And then I'm really sorry, I don't know where I've got this next reference from. It's obviously from something, a daily tune-up. It must be a daily reader or something on the 17th of October. I don't know if anybody that was at the face-to-face workshop can remember where I got this from, because I don't know. But it's a daily reader, and it's referring to what we've just talked about. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities, which is obviously on page 85 in the big book. And then the reading that went with this was, it said, how do I maintain my spiritual condition? For me, it's quite simple. On a daily basis, I ask my higher power to grant me the gift of sobriety or abstinence for that day. I have talked to many addicts who have gone back to their substance, and I always ask them, did you pray for sobriety the day you picked up? None of them said yes. As I practice step 10 and 11 and try to keep my house in order on a daily basis, I have the knowledge and experience that if I ask for a daily reprieve, it will be granted. And wherever that reading is from, I think that is a really powerful reading. So step 11 starts on the bottom of page 85 in the big book. And it says that step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. And it tells us that we shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. So step 11 has three components with explicit instructions. The first one is our instructions on what we do when we retire at night. The second lot of instructions are what we do when we wake up in the morning. And then the third lot of instructions tells us what we do as we go throughout our day. So, would somebody like to read the first paragraph that tells us what we should do when we retire at night? Somebody just let me know that they're happy to do that. Thanks, Leanne. Or Leah, I'll ask you to read the next one. Away you go, Leanne.
When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken.
Thank you so much. So they're a really simple set of instructions, aren't they? What it's telling us to do is that when we retire at night, we review our day constructively. It doesn't say this is about beating myself up. This is about finding absolutely everything that I've done wrong. It tells me that I am constructively looking at my day. What can I learn from my day? And the questions or the answers to the questions show me what still needs to be worked on. And one of the beautiful things about step 11 in terms of our evening practice is that whatever comes up in our evening practice, we can take it into our quiet time in the morning with our higher power. So once I've answered all the questions, I ask God's forgiveness and I ask to be shown what corrective measures should be taken. So again, there's many, many different ways of undertaking our evening review. Some people use an app. Again, I sometimes use the Spiritual Toolkit app that somebody mentioned in the chat. The other thing that you've got in your pack is I've also got a document that I use that I complete and I send to my sponsor. It's quite a detailed document. It's one that my sponsor gave me when we did step 11. And it basically starts off with a prayer just to kind of center myself and get myself in that space of being with my higher power. It's got a spiritual checklist in, which is just helpful to just consider as I'm doing my evening review. And then it's basically got those questions outlined just word for word. And then there's a few other additions I picked up from a really great speaker that I listened to that, two of the questions we should also ask on our evening review is, where am I being agnostic in my life? So which parts of my life am I not trusting God with? And also, what have I done to grow my relationship with God? And then there's a couple of prayers just to finish that off. So, again, my sponsor told me it doesn't matter how I do my evening review. The important thing is that I do it. And I have a really interesting experience with step 11. So, interestingly, I never ever go to bed without doing my evening review. I'm really disciplined in my evening review practice. I do my review and I choose to share it with my sponsor. The instructions don't say that we have to share it, but actually, I want my sponsor to know absolutely everything what's going on in my life. I want a recovered fellow to know what's going on in my head, and what have been my issues for the day. And then when I have my check-in with my sponsor, we pick anything up that might be pertinent from my reviews. So that's just my own personal practice. And I literally just go through all the questions and answer them. And it just gives me a sense of what my day has been like. And then if anything particular has come up, I can take that into my morning practice. So after the instructions for what we do before we go to sleep, we're then given the instructions on awakening. And interestingly, this is the bit that I really, really struggle with. And I don't know why that is. How can I be so disciplined in my evening review that I would never get into bed without doing my evening review? I just do it. I just do it. It's just like brushing my teeth. I just do it. But talk to me about my morning practice, and I am much less reliable on my morning practice, and I work step 11 imperfectly because of that. Very often I'll think, oh, my alarm will go off, and I think I'm really tired. I'm just going to snooze my alarm for 10 minutes, and then I'll get up and do it. And then I snooze my alarm for another 10 minutes, and then I'm running into the shower and saying a quick prayer as I run into the shower. And that is not going to cut it. And, I know what I am risking by not doing a proper morning practice. And yet I sometimes don't do it. It just baffles me. It's like, I think I shared at one of the workshops about, if something's good for me, I'm going to really struggle doing it, like taking my vitamin D supplements or drinking enough water. I do not know why that is, but that is just my experience. However, this last week I have had a real shift because there is a fellow in OA who has got longevity of recovery, and they do a monthly blog, and their monthly blog recently this month was about their step 11 practice. So it's very early days because I only read it a week ago, but they were describing what they did as part of the On Awakening, and it has just completely revolutionized my approach to step 11. And every day for the last 7 days, I have got up an hour earlier than I needed to, and I have done this morning practice, and it has been a complete game changer. And what I will do, I will share that with, because I'm not very techie, so I can't think how to get it into the chat because I've got it on email, but I'll share it with Eileen, and I'm sure she can kind of make that resource available to you. But what I realized is, because I'm quite a structured person, I need a bit more structure to hang my practice on than what's described in this next paragraph. That's just me. And what reading this person's blog did, it's given me the structure. So I've got my pretty notebook, and I've got my purple pens because I love writing in purple. And I'm just beside myself with excitement that I am really, really loving this morning practice. Now, in another week, I could be, back to snoozing my alarm for 10 minutes and not getting up. But you know what? I'm going to take it, because for today, I am really, really enjoying doing this. If anybody is thinking that we need to work a perfect program around this, then that is not my experience. And I am completely, bamboozled why I can be so reliable in my evening review and so unreliable in my morning review. If anybody's got any reflections on why that might be, please share it with me, because I'm just fascinated by my behavior. I really am. So would somebody read the On Awakening instructions, please? In fact, I tell you what, let's get somebody to read On Awakening till the end of the chapter, because it's kind of interspersed with what we do during the day and what we do. So let's read the whole lot together. That'll probably make more sense. Who would like to do that for us? Pop your hand up. Oh, sorry, Aaliyah. I was going to ask Aaliyah because you volunteered. Sorry. See what I mean, brain. So yeah, take it away, Aaliyah.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Oralea. I'm a compulsive overeater. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be replaced on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves that we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times a day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We compulsive eaters are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12.
That's great. Thank you so much. So yeah, there's a lot of instructions in those paragraphs that have just been read. And one of the things that I did when I got to step 11 was I went through these pages and I pulled out all the prayers and I just used the notes function in my phone. And I just made sure that I'd got all the kind of prayers in there so that I could use those on a daily basis, because there are some fabulous prayers interwoven through those pages. So we're told what to do when we wake up, and then we're told what to do as we're going about our day, because we are going to face indecision and we're not necessarily going to know what to do. And again, we're told that we ask, and when the big book says ask, it's usually talking about a prayer. So we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or decision, and then I can relax and take it easy because I'm under God's care. And it tells us that our God consciousness, that felt connection, and I talked about that in the last session, kind of, you know, for me personally, this is where I feel it, grows over time. And if I'm agitated during the day, then I need to pause. And there's lots of acronyms for the word pause, but one that I particularly like is pray and use spiritual energy. And of course, you know, sometimes I do that. You know, one of the examples that I often use is that my elderly parents live next door and they are absolutely incredible. They really are. But I can sometimes get a bit impatient, particularly with my dad. And some of that is fear, because I see them aging and it reminds me of my own kind of mortality. And then, you know, from a selfish perspective, I worry what's that going to mean for me as they're getting older. So, you know, I understand that behavior behind it. But I also know that left to my own devices, I can't behave any differently towards my parents, because I'm perfectly designed to behave as Gail behaves. The only way that I can do that is asking God for help. So I consciously, before I see my mum and dad, just kind of go into that space and just say a little prayer and just ask to be given the patience, love and tolerance for the time that I'm with my mum and dad. And that pause really, really works, because the times that I forget to do that, I'll often just be a little bit kind of short with my dad if he's kind of struggling explaining something or he's not doing something as quick as I would like, and then I have to make an amend. So yeah, that pause, I think for me, is a really, really powerful tool. But I'm definitely a work in progress, because sometimes the thing is out of my mouth before I've kind of given myself time to pause. And what I'm learning to do, and I have to do this in my recovery, is have a level of consciousness that I didn't necessarily have before. And it's like the same consciousness that we have in step 10 when we continue to watch ourselves. You know, I have to be kind of present with myself. And of course, I don't do that all the time, but being present with myself, you know, watching my thoughts, how am I feeling? And I just find that as my recovery is kind of growing, and I feel like, you know, I'm 4 years back from relapse, I feel like I'm a kind of real baby in this kind of emotional sobriety area. But I am just trying to be more conscious of what I'm feeling, because if I'm unconscious, then I'm not aware that don't be saying that, girl, you're gonna, don't say that, that's not a nice thing to say. And you know, that's why we have step 10, because I don't do that perfectly, but that is definitely what is happening to me in my recovery. And yeah, you know, the beautiful beautiful prayers around step 11, you know, reminding myself that I am not running the show. You know, how many times do we just say, your will not mine be done? You know, we must say that so frequently as kind of people in recovery. And, you know, asking to be shown through the day what my next step is to be, because I don't know. You know, remember step one, my life is unmanageable. I have no idea how my day should be. You know, what's my next step? Please give me whatever I need to take care of any problems. Keep me free from self-will, because scaling self is the problem. And then it says, you know, we don't pray for ourselves unless it will help others. And I love this. I can't remember who said it, but the person said that prayer is not about influencing God. It is about changing the nature of the one who prays. And I just think that is so beautiful. You know, I'm not asking God to give me an easy day. I'm not asking God to let this happen or let that happen. It's about changing me, because I am the one who needs changing. And then on page 88, again, this is a bit of a spiritual temperature. You know, if we do all of this, if we do this step 11 practice, it tells us that we're in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We're more efficient. We don't tire as easily, because we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. You know, being in charge of the universe is absolutely and utterly exhausting. You know, trying to control absolutely everybody and everything that's happening is exhausting. So no wonder we're exhausted, because, you know, we're trying to play God. And if I can just let go, then life just happens. It's incredible. Gail does not need to be in charge. I don't need to be in charge of my kids' lives. You know, they've got their own lives. They do lots of things that, you know, I don't necessarily want them to do. But you know what? I am not in charge of their lives. They are their own individuals. And, you know, thank God again for step 10. And then that lovely reminder that we are undisciplined. And maybe that's why I can't get out of bed to do my morning routine, because I am undisciplined and I need to let God discipline me. I take my guidance from God. And that is actually one of my prayers. You know, God, just help me in the following areas. You know, help me drink enough water. Help me take my vitamin D tablets, because God knows I need them in the UK because we don't get much sun. And please help me to get out of bed in time and do my morning routine, because I am undisciplined. And when we get to the end of all those instructions, you know, gosh, wouldn't you think we'd be done by now, because we've had instructions for step 10, we've had instructions for step 11, we've done our 6 and 7, our 8 and 9. But in my experience, the best is yet to come because we're going to talk about step 12. And I could do a whole 9 hours talking about step 12. But yeah, we've got more stuff to do because we've got step 12 to come. So I'm conscious of the time, and I'm conscious we've got quite a lot to get through in step 12. So let's move on to step 12 rather than taking time to share about people's experiences. Step 11, we can always come back to that if we get through step 12 quickly. But let's just finish our workshop with talking about the wonder that is step 12, which is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We try to carry this message to alcoholics, to compulsive overeaters, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And the spiritual principle is service. And I was told that working with others is the antidote to selfishness, and that service changes the one who serves. And one of the reasons I really love step 12 is that when I am working with others, so if I do, you know, this afternoon I did an hour with a relatively new sponsee, and for that whole hour I wasn't thinking about myself. I didn't have one thought about Gail. It was all about reading what we were reading and sharing on the reading and asking the person how they're doing in their early returning from relapse. And I just love that. I just absolutely love that, because actually, you know, Gail being in Gail's head is not a great place. That is not somewhere I want to be. So that is one of the many, many beautiful things about step 12. And I have to remember not to let the life away is given me get in the way of my recovery. Don't let the gifts of the program take me away from the program. Because as I shared with you before, you know, since I've recovered, I have an absolutely beautiful life. I just have an absolutely joyous life. You know, as I've shared with you, I usually start the morning off in a body of freezing cold water somewhere, which, you know, is an incredible way to start the day. I love moving my body. I meet up with friends. I do a lot of 12-step work. And it would be really easy to let up on my recovery actions because I'm living such a great life. And I've done that once. But I'm told that one of the ways in which I perfect and enlarge my spiritual life is through service and helping others. And I can't expect God to work for me if I don't work for God. And I think step 12 is all about working for God, because my purpose as a recovered member of Overeaters Anonymous is to help other people, to help the still suffering compulsive overeater. And in step 12, you know, all I am is an example of recovery and OA and how they've transformed my life. I walk alongside fellows and sponsees arm in arm. If I'm trying to fix you as your sponsor, then I'm trying to play God, and that is not my role. All I am there to do is to shine a light on the text in the big book to facilitate a sponsee developing a relationship with their own higher power and going on to help others. I believe that it's important. I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying this is what I believe. I believe it's important to share honestly with sponsees to show that I'm just another fellow. You know, I have not got my life sorted. And I think it also helps to build trust. So, you know, before I retired, I had a senior job in healthcare. And if you'd have seen me at work, you know, in a board meeting or dealing with a crisis, you would have looked at me. And I know this because this is what people have told me. You would have looked at me and you'd have thought, God, she's amazing. She really knows what she's doing. She's really got her act together. And inside most days, I was thinking, I'm going to get the sack. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, my God. How have I got in this senior leadership position? Somebody's going to come knocking on my door saying, Gail, get back to delivering babies. What do you think you're doing in this office, you know, in a leadership position? I had all of those thoughts. It's known as imposter syndrome. And in the last 5 years of my career, I did a lot of presentations. I used to welcome all the new healthcare professionals to the hospital. And I always made a point of sharing about my imposter syndrome, because that's how lots of other people felt. And if I didn't tell them that's how I felt, they would have no idea that that was part of my makeup, because they would just see me and think I was absolutely brilliant at my job. And the number of people that would say, oh my God, I feel like that. I can't believe you feel like that, because you certainly don't look like that when you're in work. And I think it's the same with sponsorship. You know, if I'm kind of talking through the big book with a sponsee and we're sharing, and you know, they might think, "Oh my God, Gail's really got a life together and she knows what she's doing." And there's a few people on this workshop that know me very well, and they will tell you Gail really hasn't got her life together. And I am literally just another fellow walking arm in arm with other fellows. I am kind of nothing special, you know, and trust me, I have not got my life together. So for me, I think it's really important that I share my stuff appropriately, obviously, with sponsees, because, you know, I haven't got my life sorted. And we're told that, aren't we, in step five, you know, doing a step five can be absolutely terrifying. And if your sponsor's saying, yeah, I get that, I've done that too, it immediately makes us think, God, I'm not the only one. It's like the identification around the food when we come into the rooms. I'm not the only one who does this. You know, so yeah, I have lots of step 10s. I have an imperfect step 11 practice, all of that. And when I'm reading Working with Others with a sponsee, what I always say is that my experience with this chapter is that I have to apply the principles to today's setting, because this was written a long time ago. So as an example, you know, I've never brought someone in my home to stay. I've never helped someone financially or spoken to somebody's family. So I just think that I need to adapt that to today, because usually, you know, I will come across somebody in a meeting. That's how I start working with somebody. And, you know, there's some really useful guidance in this chapter about how we work step 12. But I think we also need to be led and guided by our higher power. You know, before I work with anybody, you know, I just say a prayer to use me as a channel, use me as a vessel. And you know, I often have the experience of something will come out of my mouth that I didn't even realize I knew. And even though my big book is absolutely chock-a-block with notes, I'll find myself saying, just hang on, let me make a note of that, because I really want to capture that. And that might just be in response to something that one of my sponsees has said. And I get a completely new insight. It's just fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. It's like a sentence has only just been put in the big book. You know, I was in a big book meeting on Tuesday night, and I had that exact experience. We were reading about step four, and there was a sentence in there that wasn't underlined, it wasn't highlighted, and I was like, I don't think I've ever seen that before. And it was really pertinent to what I was experiencing. And that happens with me all the time when I'm reading this book. And this chapter also gives us some examples of how we practice these principles in all our refers, as do chapters 8, 9, and 10. And I'm conscious that we haven't covered those in this workshop, and I didn't do in the in-person retreat either. But again, in the back of the pack, there are three excellent podcasts, one each on step 8 now. On chapters 8, 9, and 10. And again, they describe those chapters better than I could ever attempt to. So I would really encourage you to listen to those. And one of the best things I heard about step 10, 11, and 12 is that I heard a speaker talk about these are they're called pipeline to the power steps. Because in step 10, in our inventory, that's where I watch for me. You know, I'm told that I continue to watch for. So I watch for me. And that clears my channel. And I was also told that I should watch for me with the same veracity that I watch others, because I can be really, really harsh on other people. And yet I don't want to look at myself as harshly as other people. I want to make excuses for myself or minimize my behavior. But when it comes to other people, you know, boy, can I take their inventory. So watching for me with the same veracity that I watch for others, and that clears my channel. And then step 11, prayer and meditation, I watch for God, and that fills my channel. And then step 12, being of service, I watch for others, and that empties my channel so it can be refilled. And I just love that analogy. It might not work for you, but that really, really works for me. And I was also told that I should be inconvenienced by service. So, you know, am I doing Step 12 work. Yes, self-care is really important, and I have to make sure that my own oxygen mask is on before I work with somebody else. But am I being inconvenienced by service? And how that translates for me is that I don't do some of the things that I would like to do. So the thing that has probably been most affected for me is that I now watch very little TV. If it's something really good and it's something that's really going to enrich my life by watching it, then I'll watch it. But I watch very, very little television because that's what I need to do to fit in all my commitments with people that I'm working with. So yeah, how am I making sure that I am working step 12 like my life depends upon it? Because actually, if somebody hadn't done step 12 with me, then I probably wouldn't be here today. And I have been given this incredible life of recovery. And, you know, I have a duty to pass that on. So again, there's loads and loads of kind of warnings in the big book about the importance of step 12. You know, on page 199, it says the fact is that he should work with other people to maintain his own sobriety. On page 128, there's a great few lines right at the bottom, just three lines up. It says, like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself, his recovery. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load, which will pay dividends only if he mines for it the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. So it's like we search for gold for the rest of our life and we give it away. That's what we're doing in step 12. On page 132, it tells us that we've recovered and we've been given the power to help others. And the start of the chapter working with others on page 89, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from compulsively overeating as intensive work with other compulsive overeaters. It works when all other activities fail. And that's a really powerful statement. So, you know, if prayer fails, working with somebody will work, it tells us. And who doesn't want immunity from compulsive overeating? You know, I'm right at the front of the queue. I want immunity from compulsively overeating because I do not want to go back to what my life was like. And then still on page 89, we have the really beautiful 12-step promises where it tells us that our life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them go on and help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up around you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. And when we work with people who recover, I just think that is such a beautiful thing to see. It's such evidence of kind of God working in people's lives. It's incredible. And then again, on page 89, we're reminded to be helpful is our only aim. You know, that is a reminder about that being our primary purpose. And, you know, I had an experience recently. I'd taken somebody through the steps a couple of times and they'd recovered and then they'd relapsed. And I'd kind of had a view that, you know, maybe they needed a different voice. Maybe I wasn't the person to take them through the steps another time, you know, a third time. And then I was talking to another fellow who had been talking to another fellow who'd talked about, you know, your aim is to be helpful. That's what you're there to do. And I suddenly thought, who am I to say that I'm not going to take this person through the steps again? That's not my decision to make. My decision is to be helpful. And if it's helpful to take that person through the steps again, then that's what I'll do. And we had that conversation and we both prayed about it and we're going through the steps again. So yeah, whatever we might think our role is or isn't, to be helpful is our only aim. And then there's quite a few pages that talk about what we actually do when we approach somebody. And again, I think this is about kind of translating those principles into kind of today's world. But it tells us on page 90 to find out all you can about a new person. But if the person does not want to stop compulsively overeating, don't waste time trying to persuade them. You may spoil a later opportunity. So somebody has to be ready. You know, we cannot make someone want to stop. We might put them off away for good. We don't force ourselves upon somebody, no matter how much devastation this disease is causing. You know, we can look at people who are, you know, incredibly morbidly obese or incredibly anorexic or incredibly bulimic, and we can see that they need OA. But, you know, we cannot force ourselves on somebody. And, you know, understanding where a person is on their compulsive overeating journey helps us to think about how we would like to be approached. Hearing someone still struggling in the food is a superb reminder of our own step one experience, especially if it's a while since we've been in the food. And that is one of the gifts of step 12. And it tells us to ask the person if they want to quit for good. And if so, would he go to any extreme to do so? It tells us on page 91 that we give him a sketch of our own eating career up to the time that we quit. And that is the identification and the hope that is really critical to newcomers. It tells us to tell the person how baffled we are, you know, and that helps the person to see themselves in us. We're not saying, oh, you're definitely a compulsive overeater. We're sharing our own experience, strength, and hope. And what happens in my experience is the person sees themselves in us and they think, I'm like that. Maybe I've got this thing as well. We show them our own experience. And, you know, if the person thinks that they can do it themselves, as it says on page 92, then we remind them that only a spiritual solution will work. And we tell them exactly what happened to us. And it tells us to talk about the spiritual solution freely, reminding the person that they can choose their own conception of God. And we emphasize being willing to believe in a power greater than them. That's all that's required. And we're told to use everyday language when describing spiritual principles. And, you know, don't let my I was told not to let my beliefs take away someone else's chances of recovery. So, you know, how I talk about my higher power might be a real turn off to somebody else. So it's stressing that fact that, you know, it's only about being willing to believe in this power, and we can choose our own conceptions of a higher power. And it also addresses a really difficult subject that, you know, if someone has religious beliefs, they may think that they've already got a spiritual solution. And, you know, if that were true, then there wouldn't be any priests or nuns in the rooms. And there's plenty of priests and nuns in the rooms. And it says on page 93, you know, however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. And this paragraph also highlights to be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. So it's likely that this can only be achieved through working the steps. And right back in the beginning, it tells us that we have to have both a belief and a dependence upon God. So it's not enough just to have faith, because if it were, then everybody that had a faith wouldn't be a compulsive overeater or an addict. We have to do more than just having faith. And on page 94, it tells us that it's important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in my own recovery. Actually, the person may be helping me more than I am helping them. So whatever the outcome of the conversation, I've had many conversations with people who have chosen to carry on compulsively overeating. They've thought that they wanted me to sponsor them, and then they said, no, I don't want you to sponsor them. And I always say, it's absolutely fine, and thank you for the opportunity of letting me speak to you, because actually this has really helped me. Every interaction we have with somebody helps us. And again, on page 94, it talks about your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all of the program. And, you know, before we've worked the steps, when we're in self, you know, we might not be too keen on what we have to offer. And, you know, I certainly had those thoughts at the start. But once I saw how hopeless my condition was, it made me much more reasonable about the solution. And that was particularly true for me when I was coming back from relapse. Page 95, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. You know, I can't beg or force someone into recovery. You know, if the person is to find God, the desire must come from within. And if somebody decides not to go down this path, it tells us not to be discouraged. You know, we leave the person be if they're not ready. You know, we might have just planted the seed and we move on, and we never know when that person, you know, the person that planted the seed for me, did that 6 months before I came to my first away meeting. We never know when we're going to plant the seed. And I have worked with some really, really beautiful people who have desperately needed this program. And we've got off to a really promising start, and then they've fallen by the wayside. And it's really hard. It's really, really hard, particularly if you really want somebody to get it. But, you know, it has to be their time. They have to be ready. It doesn't matter what I think. And we're reminded on page 97 that helping others is the foundation stone of my recovery. That's how I get to keep my recovery. I don't get to keep this unless I give it away. And, you know, I often remind sponsees that, you know, I am just that. I am a sponsor. I am not God. And it says on page 98, you know, the compulsive overeater commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. You know, I am just another human power. I am not a sponsee's higher power. And yes, in the early days, they might be heavily reliant on me. But once they're going on and getting on through the steps, you know, my first question is usually, have you prayed about it? Because I can't manage my own life and I can't manage your life. So what's God saying about this? And then we can have a conversation about a mutual sharing of experience, strength and hope. I can hold a mirror up, but I have no idea how somebody else's life should be. And another useful reminder on page 98, you know, we're reminded that, you know, people might claim that we can't master the disease until our material needs are cared for. And it says, you know, job or no job, wife or no wife, you know, there'll never be a perfect situation or time for recovery. I can recover in any set of external circumstances. Page 104, no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness is too great to overcome. And then on page 127, it tells us that material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded. And I think that's a really good reminder that whatever our personal circumstances, we can recover. You know, we don't have to have a perfect life to start a recovery journey. Page 98 tells us that we're not going to stop drinking, we're not going to stop compulsively overeating, as long as we place our dependence upon people ahead of our dependence upon God. And that is a really powerful reminder that, you know, the relationship with our higher power has to be foremost and central for us. You know, if I'm depending on, you know, my family or my sponsor or some fellows, you know, I am not going to get recovered, because they are all human powers. And we know that human power, including my power, fails us. It's about being dependent upon God. On page 99, just about a quarter of the way down, it tells us that the alcoholic, the compulsive overeater, continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerable and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. Of course, we all fall short below this standard many times, but we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree. So what this is saying is that, you know, my aim is to be abstinent, considerable and helpful, regardless of how anybody treats me or what anybody says. But I'm going to fall short of that. And thank goodness for step 10. And it's saying there's a warning there that if I don't make amends when required, I might end up back in the food. And another reminder at the bottom of the page, remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. And I tend to read that sentence with sponsees right at the start of the journey, because it's not about how good I am as a sponsor or, you know, what I bring to the table. It's about my job being to facilitate, to take that hand of the sponsee and facilitate that hand being put in the hand of their own higher power so that they can go on and help other people. And then there's just some lovely sections in this chapter. You know, on page 100, it tells us when we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances are. And that is a lovely description of the gifts of the program. And it's also a reminder that my life is no longer reliant on my external circumstances going well. The bottom of page 100, assuming we are spiritually fit, it tells us that we can do all sorts of things that compulsive overeaters are not supposed to do. But we can only do those things if we are spiritually fit. And it tells us that, you know, on page 101, we're going to meet challenging conditions every day. You know, we might be meeting up with a sponsee in a coffee shop that serves one of our alcoholic foods. And if we're spiritually fit, we will be safe and protected. And it's telling us on page 101 that we meet these conditions every day, and a compulsive overeater who cannot meet them still has a compulsive overeating mind, and there is something the matter with his spiritual status. And it uses the example of, you know, a fellow going to the Greenland ice cap to escape alcohol, and an Eskimo turns up with a bottle of scotch. You know, so we have to remember the spiritual fitness is really, really important. You know, as part of life, I am going to be in the presence of my alcoholic foods. I can't be sheltered from that all the time. But if I'm spiritually fit, connected to my higher power, I will be safe and protected, providing my motives are right. If we have a legitimate reason for being there, remember Jim's example of going to a bar for a sandwich. That probably wasn't a legitimate reason for being in a bar. I'm sure Jim could have got a sandwich from plenty of places that didn't serve alcohol. That's a good example of concerning motives. And again, on page 101, it says, in our belief, any scheme of combating compulsive overeating, which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation, is doomed to failure. If we try to shield ourselves, we may succeed for a time, but we usually wind up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. And it says, so our rule is not to avoid a place where our alcoholic foods might be if we have a legitimate reason for being there. And on page 102, it tells us if we're shaky, we better work with another compulsive overeater, because that is the answer to and for everything. And we're told that our job is to be at the place where we can be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. And if we keep on the firing line of life with these motives, God will keep us unharmed. And that is my new job description. I keep on the firing line with the motives of helping others. We're also reminded on page 103 that we're careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking, of compulsive overeating, or places that serve food as an institution. You know, we're not there to decry or condemn other solutions. You know, I have no opinion on outside issues such as kind of pay and weigh slimming clubs. You know, it tells me in tradition 10 that I have no opinion on outside issues. And on page 84, I'm told that I have ceased fighting anything. So, you know, that is not my business. And in one of the appendices at the back on page 570, something that is often not read, it tells us that, you know, AA are no crusaders. They're not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, the weeks into months and years. So, you know, that there's many, many routes. Oh. Sorry about that. Somebody was just ringing me. There are many, many routes to recovery. There are many things that people do as part of their physical abstinence. That that is not my that is not my place to judge those things. My place is just to be the best example of recovery that I can be. And it tells us on page 103, after all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles, excess food, were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. And on page 129, it tells us that it is as well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other compulsive overeaters. This will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. And that is my absolute experience with working with others. I can feel it strengthening my connection with my higher power and strengthening my recovery. You know, I can go on a call with a sponsee feeling really grumpy about something that's happening, and I can just feel my attitude changing as I'm working with somebody. We're also told that we aren't a glum lot. I've actually got a tote bag with that on. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And again, you know, that is my experience of you know, an abundant life in recovery, because we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And then at the end of A Vision for You on page 164, it tells us that we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to us. We see to it that our relationship with God is right, and great events will come to pass for us and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And then it just finishes with the beautiful paragraph, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And I was told that in the 1930s, trudge meant something different than we experience it today, because when I read that, it sounds like the road of happy destiny is really hard work. But I was told that in the 1930s, trudge meant walk or march with expectation, with a spring in my step. So I'm not trudging as if I've got lead boots on. You know, I am walking with a spring in my step along the road of happy destiny. And that has been my experience with recovery. It has just changed my life in more ways than I can even describe. And I think that's a perfect place to stop. I just want to say a really huge thank you to you all for turning up, and a really big thank you to Eileen for organizing this, for our timekeeper today, and just for everything you've shared. I have just got so much out of this workshop. It's just been amazing. And you've all been brilliant to spend the last three Sundays with. So thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to hand back over to Eileen. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Gail.